morning, everybody. We're about to start taking calls for Professor Brian Greene. Based on the material you've heard this evening, if you have a question, well, here's how you do it.
To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
In a way, theoretical physics is your wildest dreams, isn't it? Anyway, that's what my guest is all about, and if you have questions, well, here he is. We're about to begin taking questions for Professor Brian Greene. And again, his books are, and we've got a link to his website on ours, The Elegant Universe, and the one he recommends you would read now, The Fabric of the Cosmos, Space, Time, and the Texture of Reality. Once again, Professor Greene. Professor, we've been discussing this morning all matter of matter. In other words, from just down to the tiniest little, perhaps, vibrating strings, is there such a thing as antimatter?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, there is.
Yeah, there, antimatter is also one of the things that sounds more mysterious than it is, but we have learned through theoretical studies and through experimental confirmation that for every known particle in the world, say an electron, there is a particle that has the same mass, it weighs the same amount, but it has opposite electrical charge. And for the electron, its antimatter partner is called the positron. For the quarks, there are anti-quarks, and so on. So for every known particle, there is an anti-version, and if they do come into contact, they can annihilate each other, producing energy.
Lots of energy.
Yes.
How would the amount of energy produced for the amount of mass involved compared to a nuclear reaction?
Well, it's actually more efficient. If you do have a particle and antiparticle, they convert all of their mass into energy through collisions. But again, these particles have very tiny amount of mass, so in practical overall terms, it's not much energy compared to that which you can produce through conversion of macroscopic amounts of matter into energy as happens in a nuclear bomb.
So we're pretty sure then that there are not scattered about the galaxy masses of antimatter that could conceivably...
It's a good question, though, because conceivably there could be, but reason why we suspect there aren't because we don't see the kinds of releases of energy that would occur if those antimatter planets, if you will, came into contact with a matter.
Well, maybe less than a planet and more than a pebble. I was thinking, for example, of Tunguska, which was such an interesting explosion. You know, it flattened forests and all that,
yep.
But didn't leave this big hole in the ground or anything. And I just got to wondering whether there could be an antimatter mass that would suddenly, you know, come in contact with our massive world with the resulting... kaboom.
Yeah, again, it's not impossible, but it's hard to imagine how that would actually happen.
Huh. We need to go to the phones and let some people ask questions. You never know what you're going to get, so all I can say is brace yourself. Good morning. You're on the air with Professor Brian Greene. Where are you, please? Hello?
Are you talking to me?
I am.
Oh, hi. I'm from California.
From California. All right, very good. What's her first name?
Karen.
Karen, what kind of question have you?
I was just wondering, is he atheist or trying to figure out in which the way that God created us and the world?
All right, a fair question.
I wouldn't really call myself an atheist. If we're going to use conventional terms, I think I would call myself an agnostic because, again, I'm not a scientist who rules out the possibility of God. I'm one who says... that it's definitely possible, but I see absolutely no evidence for it, and I keep my mind open to that possibility, but it hasn't shown itself to me in any convincing way, and therefore I follow the laws of physics, and so far that's all that I think we need to understand the universe. But if there is a God behind it all, that's fantastic, and it's a noble quest to understand God's laws. I don't think that's the framework within which we're working. I think it's just the laws of physics, but I don't know that for a fact, so I leap open that possibility.
Professor, intelligent design, though, it sure does seem to those of us, like Karen and myself, you know, as we walk around, that there has to be some sort of intelligent design. Things are just too damn perfect.
Well, I think, frankly, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way, I think that may come from not having grasped the power of the laws of physics. The laws of physics can be very simple laws, very simple ideas, but yet they can give rise to a tremendous amount of order and organization and harmony in the world around us. So I think once you have experienced seeing those laws in action, you recognize their power and you recognize that they can yield a universe that appears to be designed by some intelligent designer, but in fact it's just the laws of physics responsible for what you see.
There you have it, Karen.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Take care. First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Brian Greene. Hi.
Hi, this is Christopher in Miami. Is it me?
It is you.
Oh, great. Professor Greene, great to talk to you, Art. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just started your book, actually, about 4 days ago, the first one, The Elegant Universe, so it's pretty interesting that you're on. Good to talk to you. A couple of quick things. I guess I was just thinking, it's already getting difficult for me. I'm just on the essentials of superstring theory, but the one idea about when you're saying if a person went and you'd mentioned before, this is about, I guess, in a way about time travel, but talking about a person being lowered down onto the edge of a black hole and how the time would really move much at a much different rate at that point. Then I was thinking, like, isn't it almost the same thing even on this planet if you were just, like, frozen cryogenically and then, you know, you were thawed out like 1,000 years from now? Isn't it basically the same thing? I know it is, in a way it's time travel, but really it's you're moving at a different speed. And then...
Yeah.
I guess I draw
a fundamental distinction between those two possibilities. So, and again, just to give a moment of background, in previous hours we were discussing how if you move relative to somebody else, time will slow down for you. What you're referring to is something we didn't quite discuss, which is that if you are immersed in a strong gravitational field, then time slows down for you relative to somebody who isn't experiencing that strong gravity field. So, indeed, if you were hovering just outside the edge of a black hole, time for you would slow down relative to someone who's far away from the black hole. Now, in terms of practical implications, indeed, if you freeze yourself and you thaw yourself out sometime later on, then you will have experienced less aging in your body than you would have or than somebody else would who didn't freeze themselves. But you were still experiencing time. You just slowed down biological processes, but time is still doing what it always does. What we are saying is if you do these more exotic things like travel near the speed of light or hover just outside the edge of a black hole, then it's time itself, not just biological processes, but time itself is elapsing at a different rate, and that's fundamentally different.
I'm going to go back and read again because I don't think I'm quite getting it, but it's so great to talk to you. And the other thing I absolutely believe, and I'm right on with you, is about the idea of spending the money towards science instead of war. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome. It is a big issue, isn't it, where we spend our money. I mean, we have backed away from space in a really big way since we did that incredible thing and put men on the moon.
Yeah.
We've just backed so far away. I mean, the shuttle is getting old. I guess there's going to be a replacement, but I don't see it yet. And I don't know. It's like we've stalled in so many areas.
Yeah, I agree. And part of what I hope, you know, through, you know, the books I've written and the TV shows that I've done, if in some way I can contribute to the enthusiasm for discovery, the enthusiasm for science, maybe there can be a bit of a public upswelling of support for putting our resources back into fundamental research.
Well, Professor, it doesn't seem as though today's youth, and I sound like the typical old person complaining, but I don't know, they're just not being as fired up about things technological as they once were, and it's a great concern.
Well, I think that's a problem with the educational system because, you know, I go out and I give lectures around the country and I encounter students who tell me that they've thought science and physics is boring, but then they come to a lecture in which the cutting-edge ideas are explained in a way that they can grasp and they get excited about science. I mean, I get emails from 10, 11, 12-year-olds who watch this NOVA program that we did on my first book, The Elegant Universe, who have decided they want to go into science. And before they saw this program, they didn't, which is just one small example of how if we as a nation can really put our resources behind education that will not be rote, that won't be boring, but will be exciting and compelling, then I think we can turn it around and make science the thing that kids want to do and want to study. I see this as a real possibility and a real responsibility for us to have a future that we want to be part of.
Well, Professor, some of it may have to do with the quality of teaching. In other words, being able to really grab these young minds. I find that, for example, I've got a new, widescreen plasma, high-definition TV here. And when you are on channels like Discovery or watching programs like NOVA, as you mentioned, the magnetism of those programs is just incredible. And I find myself sitting there thinking, you know, Discovery ought to be on plasma TVs in every schoolroom in America, and there'd be so much interest as opposed to a sort of a very dry classroom approach. And I understand there has to be some of that, but...
Yeah. No, I agree. In fact, when we did our NOVA program, part of what we did was create a teacher's manual and make the DVD widely available so that it could be a teaching tool in schools. And to some extent, you know, it has been used in that way. But, you know, one thing that I find striking is, you know, when you go to an elementary or junior high school, oftentimes there's a specialty teacher in music or art because those are fields which we view as requiring an expert. Why isn't there a specialty teacher always in the field of math and in physics? I mean, those are equally difficult and equally specialized fields, but oftentimes it's the same teacher that has to be responsible for math and science and English and history, and that's such a huge burden. I think if we really put the resources in, we'd have specialists to teach the fields that are difficult, like math and science, and perhaps make use of the resources that you're mentioning, you know, the Discovery programs, the NOVA programs, and make science the most exciting subject.
There you are.
Not one of the more boring ones.
All right. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Professor Brian Green. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, this is Jim from Milwaukee.
Yes, Jim.
I just to play devil's advocate here, Professor Brian Green, if I was throwing dice in Atlantic City and my friend was throwing dice in Las Vegas, Nevada, there is no way we could throw a 1 through 6 with a pair of dice. It would kind of have to be 2 to 12, wouldn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry. It was just a small miscommunication. What I meant was take a single pair of dice.
He knew what you meant.
I knew what you meant. I had to play devil's advocate.
I had a question
or a statement that as far as what you had said about traveling back in time or in the future. Now, you had said if you went back and you changed things and your parents didn't meet, then you wouldn't be here. But why would you have to be able to change anything? Because if you went in the future, you wouldn't be able to change anything. So if you went in the past, you may go back as an observer as such.
And simply not be able to change anything.
Exactly.
I see. Okay. Well, Professor, I suppose that's one of the thought of exceptions, that you might get to the past and simply be only able to observe.
That's right. So as I mentioned, you know, there are these potential paradoxes that you change the past in a way that maybe prevents your own existence. But I also mentioned that people have dreamed up ways around those paradoxes. And one way around is exactly what the caller is suggesting. Perhaps if you were able to travel to the past, a huge if, but let's take it. Imagine you were able to travel to the past. Maybe the laws of physics prevent you from changing things, or at least from changing things in a way that would yield a logical paradox, such as you don't exist. That is something which people have proposed as one way around this potential obstacle to being able to travel to the past. Indeed, that's a possibility.
Isn't there some place in here where we could begin talking about dimensions? In other words, we observe and live within the laws of the three dimensions, but we believe there are more dimensions. Perhaps, as one would observe from another dimension if they were able to, but not affect.
Right. Well, I would even say slightly differently, although, you know, same flavor. Another possible way around this paradox of changing the past is that maybe there are parallel universes. So quantum physics does suggest the possibility that what we see around us is simply one universe of many, 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 all of which exist in parallel, if you will. And it could be that, again, huge if you could travel to the past, maybe you can only ever travel to the past of not your own universe, but a parallel copy of your universe. Mm-hmm. So if you go to that parallel copy and you kill off your parents and you are never born, well, there's no paradox. You are not born in that copy of a universe, but your own origin is still understood. You were born in the universe from which you started your journey.
Do you tend to buy into this?
Well, I am not a great believer in the parallel universe, the multiple universe interpretation of quantum physics. It is a viable possibility, and many people have staked their careers on this being the right way of thinking about quantum physics.
Yes, indeed.
So, you know, I'm open to it, but I consider it to be a rather excessive way of interpreting the rules of quantum physics, but maybe it will be the one that we're led to when, you know, the final I is dotted and T is crossed. That's possible.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Green. Hi.
Bob of Mansfield, Ohio. It's been announced that the children downwind of Chernobyl have higher reaction rates and higher IQ than neighboring children. And to the extent that the human mind is a quantum calculator, does the Professor Green have a explanation for this?
Well, first of all, I'm not aware that that was a fact. Where did you glean that information?
Paul Harvey about 2 days ago.
No kidding. Okay, Professor, that is interesting. Paul Harvey apparently reporting that the children downwind of Chernobyl have developed higher IQs. Were you aware of that?
No, I never heard that. No, so I don't know anything about it.
Well, nor have I, but extremely interesting caller, and I'll see what I can find out, or somebody will send me something on it, and we'll look into it, depend on it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Brian Green. Hello.
Hello, yes, I have a question.
Okay.
You're talking about traveling back in time. Now, if you were to go back in time, would that cause a huge butterfly effect?
Okay, well, let's tackle the butterfly effect since you called. The butterfly effect, Professor, can you explain it?
Well, the butterfly effect is the idea that a small change in the conditions today can yield a huge change in the conditions 100 or 1,000 or 10,000 years from now. So the prototypical example that people often talk about is, you know, maybe you accidentally step on a butterfly at some moment in time, and you don't think that really matters very much, but that little butterfly, if it had lived, would have flapped its little wings, that would have moved a few air molecules, that would have moved some others, and perhaps those molecules would have created some tremendous hurricane, you know, 100 years later. So it's the idea that small changes can be amplified over time into big changes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that makes perfect sense. There's a whole field of science called chaos theory, which has really established that many of the laws that govern phenomena in the world around us have a chaotic property, which means that tiny changes in the conditions that you start with are amplified by those laws into big changes later on. So this is something that is well understood, and there are many, many examples of it.
So then, conceivably, that process could be underway all the time, all around us, accounting for what is seemingly otherwise random occurrences.
Yeah, absolutely. And this has been documented, certainly, in, you know, weather systems and complex phenomena of that sort. But the caller is asking, you know, were you to travel to the past, could there be a huge butterfly effect? And
right.
That's sort of another version of the killing off your parents. But now, rather than it being one dramatic act of homicide, you do one tiny thing which gets amplified over time into some dramatic change later on. Again, we don't know that we can travel to the past. I think we probably can't. But if you could, I suspect that somehow there's a mechanism that prevents that kind of changing of the future from taking place, because again, that change might prevent your own birth. And that kind of logical paradox is something that the laws of physics must somehow prevent from happening.
Well, I hope it is all that ordered. Professor Brian Green is my guest. Good morning in the darkness, which is where we operate most of the time. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell.
You think that people would have had enough of a silly love song? I look around me and I see it isn't so. Some people want to fill the world with silly love songs. And what's wrong with that? I'd like to know. Here I go.
Take a ride? To talk with Art Bell, call the wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning. You're traveling in time this morning with Professor Brian Green. The stuff we're all made of, really. That's what we're talking about. The matter that we're all made of. What we don't know is how we got made, right? From the high desert, it all continues with you in a moment. Well, all right. Interestingly, you just had to know it would come. Melissa from, well, I don't know where she's writing from, quotes an article in The Sun, that's the UK Sun, entitled Mutant Children Are Best. The Chernobyl nuclear disaster has spawned a generation of mutant super brainy children. Kids growing up in areas damaged by radiation from the plant do in fact have a higher IQ and faster reaction time. Hope this helps. Well, it helps, but it just piques my curiosity intensely. Professor, that is strange, isn't it?
It sounds strange, and again, I don't know anything about it, and I wouldn't use the sun as a primary source, but, you know, it's curious.
At least not a primary source in that sense.
Yeah.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Brian Green. Good morning.
Good morning, Professor. I wanted to know about you're talking about the time travel and the timeline, and you were saying something about the three different... past, present, and future, all three being both independent of themselves, but also functioning at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Would that not also create, in a sense, a way where no matter what you did, you could not affect the future, and no matter what you did in the past couldn't affect the future, and no matter what you are doing in the present, it was already predetermined by what your future already has in store.
Boy, that's a pathetic thing, if true. I mean, that means we're all virtual little marionettes, unknowingly dancing to the strings, perhaps super strings, holding us up. I don't know. Professor?
Well, I think we are. I mean, it is a strange thought, but, you know, the laws of physics do dictate the behavior of the particles that make us up. So from that point of view, our particles, our atoms, our molecules, and if string theory is correct, our strings are executing motion that is dictated by the laws of physics. So you say, where does free will come into this?
Yes.
We seem to have control over what we do. Are we somehow being controlled by the laws of physics? And the answer is yes. We, all of our actions are governed by the laws of physics. Now, does that mean that we are automatons, marionettes, as you describe it? Yeah, I don't think so, because we still have our minds, and our minds are reflective of our personality and our characteristics and so forth. But if you dig deep enough, I think that all does rest on the foundation of the laws of physics, and that's just how it is.
Well, you're kind of saying, well, that is how it is, but don't let it bother you, but that is how
it is. I think that's the only way you can live. You know, if you ask me, where does free will fit in the laws of physics? Well, I kind of don't see it in the laws of physics. There's no equation where I can say, oh, that's where free will is. That's where free will gets folded into our understanding of the universe. Instead, at least the way I make sense of it is that I am governed by the laws of physics, but I have a really strong sense of self and a strong sense of control.
Perhaps
that
all
might
false.
Be kind of illusory.
Ah.
It's kind of maybe kind of illusory, but nevertheless, it's how I go about and live my everyday life. So there's almost a two-pronged approach to living. On one level, you really feel that you have control, and you have to live your life that way. On the other hand, I know that everything I'm made up is governed by laws of physics, and it's going to do what it's going to do, and the laws of physics dictate that behavior.
Huh. So you just learn to live with that illusion.
That's how I deal with it personally, yes, absolutely.
Wild card line.
Well, can I say one more thing on that?
You may.
You know, maybe at some point we will see where free will is in physics. And maybe we'll be able to pinpoint and say, oh, that's free will. That's that feeling that we all have. There it is in the math. But we haven't done that yet, and we perhaps never will.
Wildcard line, you're on the air with Professor Green. Hi.
Hi. Is it me?
It's you.
Oh, awesome. Well, I love your show.
Thank you.
And I learned so much from your show, and you had a guest on, and I've been trying to look on my computer, but I can't find it. So a few weeks or months may not do it too far ago, but he said that when God decided to create us, that in itself caused the Big Bang, and as we all die and we get back united with God, the space gets bigger, God gets bigger, and so he was listening to St. Augustine. I think it was one of the doctors of the Catholic Church. I believe it was St. Augustine's argument for God was that the soul is immaterial, and so when the body dies, that immaterial soul goes on. And so I just put the two together and thought, well, there our soul is might be that part of space that we don't know what that part is. Maybe that's God itself. And so,
okay. Well, actually, I had a guest who had a rather elegant theory. I thought one of the more interesting ones, and that was that God was an entity, very much alone, and that the Big Bang was God virtually exploding himself, if you want to think of it that way, and that, therefore, God is all that is. So it's as good a theory as any, Professor.
Well, I guess, you know, I wasn't listening to that particular program, so I don't know exactly what the guest said. But when you say it's as good a theory as any, I would simply stress the following. I, as a physicist, judge a theory by the prediction that it can make. And our current laws of physics do make predictions. For instance, temperature of the background radiation that we can measure with satellites and things of that sort. And that's what convinces me that our theories are good. I would only consider a theory as good as ours if it could make predictions that we could test. That's my yardstick. I'm not saying it's the only yardstick, but it's the one I believe in.
Okay, well, by that measure then, quantum fluctuation in terms of an explanation for us and all that is might be a little understated.
Well, that's why I say that we don't understand the origin of the universe yet, simply because we can't test and we can't make predictions that really allow us to adjudicate between one explanation for the origin of the universe versus another. And that's why I say it's currently unknown. But there's much about the world that we do know with our current laws of physics. I mean, we can measure, for instance, the magnetic properties of electrons. Mm-hmm. And the answer we get from our measurements agree with the answers we predict from our equations to 1 part in 10 billion. I mean, that's a fantastic agreement between a math calculation using a pencil and a piece of paper and an observation of the real world.
Right.
And that's my yardstick. And that's why I always want to subject ideas to the question, does the theory make a prediction that we can go out and test?
Great. And modern, today's physics certainly does, and that's fine. But now we get up to this quantum level where guys like yourselves probably end up bashing their head on the desk.
No. There's much about quantum physics that is very hard to accept intuitively, but it makes predictions that we can test. So this example that I mentioned about the magnetic property of electrons, that's a quantum mechanical calculation. So we use the laws of quantum physics to get numbers that agree with observations. So
yes.
However unfamiliar the laws are, we are able to test them, and that's what's important to me.
All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Green. Good morning.
Hi. If you had a million-mile-long piece of chain out in space somewhere, and you tug on one end of it, is the reaction on the other end instantaneous? Or does
No, certainly not.
It has to be limited by the speed of light.
Absolutely.
The dark matter you're talking about, how close is that to Earth, the nearest dark matter?
It's right where you're sitting right now.
All around you.
It's all around us.
You can't feel it?
Spread.
You can't feel it or anything?
Yeah,
or?
It's actually passing through your body right now. If these ideas are correct, then dark matter particles are streaming right through your body right now. They interact very feebly with ordinary matter, and therefore the dark matter particles typically pass right through you without any noticeable effect.
You're like Swiss cheese, sir.
Absolutely.
Thank you much.
You're very welcome. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Professor Green. Good morning.
Good morning to you both. I have two questions to pose to the good professor, as well as a quick comment of about all the things I've been hearing tonight. The first question would be, can the expansion of the universe, or is the expansion of the universe caused by the black holes we see or have discovered around?
Yeah, we don't think so. The expansion of the universe seems to be uniform, whereas a black hole is at one location and therefore would preferentially have an effect in its local environment. Mm-hmm. We don't think a black hole can explain the expansion of the universe.
Interesting. Also, how can we be sure that the whole universe is not a black hole?
Well, in fact, the whole universe could be a black hole. We could, in fact, be inside a black hole right now,
yes,
heading toward its singularity, which would, in effect, be the end of time. This is definitely a possibility, so it's not
right.
Ruled out.
Right.
Oh.
Also, which brings me to my comment, which would be, it seems that life is an external reality, and an external reality cannot be sustained by an imaginary command, which makes me think that the purpose of the universe is to sustain life, and the purpose of life is to sustain faith. With the right faith, it seems you may be able to conquer the universe. Would that be fair to say, Professor?
Huh.
Well, you can certainly say it, and if it makes you happy, you can even believe it, but I don't see any direct connection between life's existence and the universe's existence. They certainly are correlated, but I don't see any purposeful reason for life in the makeup of the fundamental laws of the universe.
Professor,
so there is that link. I don't see any reason why life is so central mm-hmm. to the workings of the universe.
All right. Professor, you mentioned moving toward the singularity. You mentioned the end of time.
Yeah.
Now, if such an event were to be, we were to be moving toward such an event, what would we begin to notice? Would there be any notice on Earth and among mankind? Would we realize at some point what we were getting close to, or would it just happen?
Well, let me give you the closest example. We believe that there are black holes in space. This is an observational fact that most scientists believe in.
Right.
Imagine you were to fall into a black hole. What would happen? Well, not much would happen at first if the black hole were big enough. But after a while,
you'd start to feel a real strong gravitational tug on your feet that was stronger than the one on your head, and your body would begin to be stretched. And as you got closer and closer to the center of the black hole, you'd be spaghettified, we say. You'd be stretched out, and ultimately you'd be pulled apart. That's what you would experience. Now, let me just emphasize one point. Often people think about the center of a black hole as some place in space. In reality, when you study black holes, you recognize that the center of a black hole is not a particular point in space. It's a point in time. It's where time ends. So if you fall over the edge of a black hole, mm-hmm. when you hit its center, you have actually reached the end of time.
If we were so moving, Professor, we would begin to notice these things, the physical world around us. We wouldn't instantly expire or cease to exist, but rather we'd slide into it. Is that correct?
That's right. If we're all right now falling toward that center of a black hole,
yes.
Yeah, you'd begin to see anomalies that would grow larger and larger. But the unfortunate thing is there'd be nothing you could do to prevent your reaching this singular point of the black hole, at least according to Einstein's laws of general relativity. So even if you notice that something was starting to look a little strange, there's nothing you could do to prevent or change your fate.
Is there any way to understand how much time man would have, how much warning man would have?
Yes, you can calculate it based upon sort of the size of the black hole that you fall into. You can calculate how long it will take before you reach the center, until you reach this singularity. This is a math calculation, and if you give me the mass of the black hole, I can do the calculation and tell you how much time you'd have. The bigger the black hole, the more time you have.
Got it. Good morning. You're on the air with Brian Green, Coast to Coast AM, with Art Bell and so forth. Hello there. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I wanted to ask him if he is familiar with the book by Thomas Bearden called The Energy from the Vacuum.
Ah, yes. Professor?
No, I don't know that book. Sorry.
Well, okay. But nevertheless, you can probably comment on the possibility from a physics point of view that eventually either dark matter this so-called zero-point energy, this energy that is supposedly all around us that we don't quite understand, might be harnessed in a day when, well, frankly, our worldwide fuel supplies are at some peril.
Yeah. You know, I have heard a number of individuals who have tried to discuss harnessing the zero-point energy as a limitless source of energy that's in the environment all around us, and I don't personally think it's possible. I think most physicists don't think it's possible, because it turns out that the zero-point energy sets a benchmark. It's as if it is the zero, and only energies in excess of that zero can be harnessed. This at least is what appears to be the case when you study quantum physics, and therefore I do not put any faith in these possibilities of harnessing the zero-point energy as a real source of energy that we'd be able to utilize. So I don't see it happening.
Well, then, I wonder how you feel about the fact that we may be at or about to enter what's called peak oil, which means we've used half the oil, the cheap half that we can use, and the other half is going to be hard, expensive to get, and will cause wars to get at. In other words, the world's in big trouble energy-wise.
Yeah, it's a real issue.
So are you physicists going to yank our butts out of the trouble here? Or?
Well, you know, there are possibilities. I mean, nuclear energy, if harnessed in an appropriate and safe manner, is a fantastic source of energy. And people are certainly working on alternative approaches to nuclear energy where it's fusion as opposed to fission. Fusion would be a much safer approach. It's something that we've been unable to accomplish. I mean, that's how the sun creates energy. It fuses atoms together, and in the fusion process, energy is released. If we can reproduce the sun's mechanism for producing energy, if we can reproduce that on Earth, that would be a fantastic achievement, and certainly it would be the alternative to the fossil fuel approach that we have long since followed.
How many years away from fusion might we be?
I don't know. Again, I wish I could predict the rate of scientific progress. People have been working on fusion for a long time with only limited progress. We need some, you know, wonderful new idea, wonderful new approach, wonderful new technology, and the wonderful thing about science is that breakthroughs do happen at the least expected moment. So who knows? Maybe it's not that far off.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with Professor Brian Green. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, Professor.
Hi.
These are some of my favorite shows. I just wanted to say when you guys were talking about physics and the time travel kind of made me think of something. If you can't go back to a point in time before the time machine was built, then you probably couldn't go back in time before you existed either, which most people would want to go back in time to see, like, biblical times or some historical event. But if you hadn't been born yet, you couldn't go back to that time anyway, right?
I have a feeling the professor would choose the moment of creation.
I mean, if I had a choice to go back?
That's right.
Yeah, that would be the one for me.
That's the big one. And the caller is suggesting you might not be able to go back prior to even your own existence.
Well, again, I mean, if the first time machine, again, huge hypothetical, you know, was constructed in the year 2500, and you were born in the year 2600, mm-hmm. then, yeah, you could go to a moment before your own birth in that hypothetical scenario.
Huh. Squeeze one more in. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Professor Green. Hi.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Professor.
Hi.
If I can understand time travel as much as a layman can understand it, it's if you're able to propel yourself the speed of light squared, 186,000 miles per second squared, that's when you're able to achieve time travel.
At any speed you achieve time travel, if you walk across the room and walk back, you are actually a little bit younger than the person that was sitting still on the couch. The amount that you are younger, however, is so tiny, it's a billionth of a second, you don't notice it. So the faster you go, the more the time travel takes place and the more manifest it becomes. Near the speed of light, it's the largest effect that it could be. So indeed, if you want to jump thousands of years into the future, that speed is what you'd need to achieve.
Well, right now we need to achieve the end. We're falling to the end of time. Professor, it has been a pleasure having you on the air. You're brilliant. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Good night, my friend.
Good night.
Take care. And we are falling indeed to the end of time. Well, for this particular program anyway. It's been a pleasure, everybody, an absolute pleasure. And we'll get together tomorrow night about same time, same station. And we'll do it again from the high desert. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. Filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun